Okay, well, the organizers asked me to talk about work that the Milk Collaboration has been doing with three flavors of the improved Stagger Quarks. But they also asked me to say what was likely to be done. And my first reaction to that was to recall the sage advice of Yogi Berra and or Niels Bohr to the effect that predictions are difficult, particularly about the future. However, on second thought, these large lattice simulations move so slowly that you actually can say what's going to happen, at least in the near future. And so I'll try to do as the organizers requested. Here are the current members of the Milk Collaboration, and I've listed some other collaborations who are using milk configurations, and there are more than individuals and collaborations that are there, but these are some of the groups whose work I will at least mention in passing. Okay. Now, the objective is to perform calculations of QCD in the non-perturbative regime to an accuracy that it can really have an impact on high energy and nuclear physics. And of course, we and many other people have been trying to do this for a long time. I think we're actually to the point where we can start to do that. It's taken a long time because there are, It's taken a long time because there are some important challenges which you all know about. You have to include the effects of up, down, and strange quarks. The other quarks are so massive that their closed loops aren't, I think, important to the accuracy we're trying to get to right at the moment. With modern computers, or with current computers, I should say, you can perform simulations with quarks of the mass of the strange quark, but we're not to the point where we can perform simulations at the physical masses of the up and down quarks. So what one has to do is work at a range of up and down quark masses and try to extrapolate to their physical values. And of course, chiral perturbation theory is an excellent guide, which we make use of. We have to perform simulations for a range of lattice spacings to enable extrapolations to the continuum limit. And there's certainly a high premium on using actions that don't have large lattice artifacts to start with. Finally, one has to worry about finite size effects, which one expects to go approximately like e to the minus m pi L, where L is the size of the box in which, the physical size of the box in which one's doing the simulation. So as you make the lattice spacing smaller to keep L fixed, you've got to go to more lattice points in the spatial and temporal directions. And as you make the up and down quark masses smaller, the pion mass on the lattice gets smaller, and again, you have to go to larger lattices, and all of this is driving you to very large lattices. So over the last several years, the Milk Collaboration has tried to generate sets of configurations which meet all of these challenges. We do include up, down, and strange quarks. We keep the strange quark mass fixed as close to its physical value as we can during the course of the simulations. I've defined here ML or M light as the average up and down quark mass, and we want to we generate configurations with a range of M light to enable extrapolations to the physical value. We actually do the simulations with the up and down quark masses equal, and for isospin average quantities, that error is of doing that is very small. Or so we estimate from chiral perturbation theory. Okay, well, here's a list of configurations that currently exist. And with each set of parameters, I think there are, you know, we generate the configurations. You can use them then to do a lot of different physics. And typically, we have of order 500 or so configurations at each parameter, not all of them completely independent. Okay. The first big set we did were these ones with lattice spacing 0.125 Fermi, which we tend to call coarse lattices, and you'll see that name on some of the later figures. Again, the strange quark mass is approximately equal to its physical value, and then the light quark masses range from a tenth all the way up to the strange quark mass. At a tenth of the strange quark mass, the pion is about 250 MeV, and that light quark mass, therefore, is approximately three times the its physical value, but it's still one tenth the strange.
Good.
Excuse me? All these configurations are with improved fermions. Absolutely. In this set of runs, all of them are on 20 cubed by 64 lattices, except the tenth of the strange quark one, which is 24 cubed. There is one at 2/10 of the strange quark mass, really not listed here, which is 28 cubed by 64 to test for finite size effects, and we didn't find any there. Mpi L is greater than or equal to 3.8, and that low value is only on the light for the lightest quark mass. The second set of configurations are these A equal 0.09 Fermi lattices, which we tend to call fine ones. And here we have three completed sets at 28 cubed by 96 and mpi L greater than 4.2 or equal to. Okay. The top ones, the 0.18, which sometimes are called extra coarse, were actually generated to set the scale for some thermodynamics calculations, which I will show you at the end if I don't run out of time. And we've only recently started to see whether they will help in the chiral extrapolation, but none of what I'm going to show you makes use of those. Now, what's coming next? We are currently running a set at 0.09 Fermi's at a tenth of the strange quark mass on 40 cubed by 96 lattices with mpi L of 4.2. We're going to do about a third of that at National Supercomputer Centers, which is where we did everything in the last slide. But the bulk of this run is going to be on the, we hope, on the QCDOC that was designed by Norman Crist and his collaborators at Columbia and is at this moment being built at Brookhaven National Laboratory. And similarly, we hope to do a set at 0.06 Fermi on the QCDOC, although the 2/10 of the strange quark mass lattices, which are very expensive, we're planning to do jointly with UKQCD. I should have mentioned that the lattice artifacts on the 0.09 Fermi lattices are approximately half the size of those on the 0.125 lattices, and on the 0.06 lattices, the lattice artifact should be down by another factor of three from the 0.09 one, so that we hope that we are really beating down the finite lattice spacing errors. I wanted to emphasize that all of these configurations are publicly available. The ones where the runs are complete are at NERSC, in the NERSC gauge connection, and we've also, the ones that are in progress, make available on request. I think that the field has to work this way. The generating gauge configurations is just too expensive for individual groups to, you know, keep generate lattice, keep them to themselves. Obviously, you want to generate sets with different actions and so on. It's not that you want to stop generating configurations, but you shouldn't have to repeat. Everybody shouldn't have to repeat. I think we get in big trouble with the funding agencies if we do that. I'm proud of the fact that Milk was sort of the spearheaded this. There is an international movement to do just this, and I think this is going to be done in the future. Some people worry about, oh, gee, if I give my lattices away, then someone else is going to scoop me on a calculation I want to do. Actually, I think our experience is absolutely the reverse. We've gained a lot from the calculations that other people have done on our configurations. And I'll try to point that out as I go along. Okay. Now, these configurations are generated with a one-loop semantic improved gauge action and an improved staggered quark action, sometimes called A squared TAD, because like the gauge action, all lattice artifacts through order A squared, A being the lattice spacing, are removed at the tree level, and then their tadpole improved. So that the leading discretization errors are of order A squared over log A. Okay. Yes? Yeah, because a different way, this is A squared alpha strong. If you want to say an alpha strong goes to zero, like 1 over log A. Okay? In other words, right, the A squared terms are out, but when you turn on the interactions, you get A squared alpha strong. And that's why. That's why. Okay? Now, one of the very first things we did when we started playing with this action was to just do a quench spectrum calculation to try to check to see where we were. And here is a calculation in the quenched approximation of the row mass. This quantity R1 sets the scale. It's just a parameter you can calculate very easily from the heavy quark potential. And this calculation is done for fixed pion mass, so a way of keeping the quark mass fixed. The purple squares are using the pieces of the action that we're going to use, and you see it's quite independent of A squared as it's supposed to be. The rightmost point is, I think, something like 0.2 Fermi's, so over long range. You see the conventional Kogut-Suskind action. It's heading towards the same value in the continuum limit, but it has large order A squared pieces, and then there's some clover terms. Recently, Christine Davies and Doug Toussaint have repeated this, including a lot more actions. You can still see the same A squared TAD points here, but you know, perfect actions and domain wall and such. What they wanted to do, what they were looking at, was whether knowing what the leading and maybe the first subleading corrections in A were for each of these actions, was it consistent to fit everybody to have the same continuum limit? And they found that it was. Again, they hold the pion mass fixed. And same thing for the nucleon. Okay, so that's encouraging. In fact, you would be really worried, or at least I would be very worried, if that didn't happen. Okay, now I need to say a word, or more than a word, about staggered quarks. The major advantage is that they allow simulations with light seed quarks with current computers. So that. What was certainly attractive to us when we started. Other actions are going to become feasible, but when we started, certainly these were the only ones. They have a major disadvantage also, and that is what's come to be known as Tay symmetry breaking. A single Kogut-Suskind field actually describes four quarks. Those four quarks become degenerate only in the continuum limit. And that means that if you make the same physical particle from different tastes, of course, as those four different quarks described by the one field are called, you'll get slightly different masses. The mass splittings are of order A squared, or A squared alpha S. the good news is, and they go to zero in the continuum. The splittings go to zero in the continuum limit. The good news is that the improved action significantly reduces asymmetry breaking as compared to the conventional Kogut-Susskind action. In fact, that's a major part of the improvement. The improvement has two pieces in it. One is simply to improve the derivative by not just using nearest neighbor points in the derivative, but longer range ones. The second one is to fatten up the links, so it's not just the shortest link between two points, but some average over for links which are as long as 7 steps. And they can be, and the contributions of those can be adjusted both to cancel the order A squared errors and to improve the asymmetry breaking. Even better news is that Lee and Sharp and Aubin and Bernard have developed staggered chiral perturbation theory, which takes into account the taste breaking, takes into account the leading order in A, which are, again, alpha squared, A squared alpha S terms, and thereby enabling extrapolations both to the chiral limit and to the continuum limit. So that's very important. So that's the good news about staggered quarks. The bad news is that as follows. I think you all know very well, to do the simulations, you have to integrate out the fermions, and that gives rise to a determinant of the Dirac operator, which you incorporate into the weight function for the gluon fields. If you had NT degenerate quarks, then you would get a piece that looks like determinant of M to the NT, or M to the Dirac operator. In the staggered operator in the continuum limit, you would get the determinant of a single quark operator to the fourth power, therefore to have one taste per flavor in the continuum limit, one takes the fourth root of the determinant, or with equal up and down quarks, you take the square root for them and the fourth root for the strange quark mass. Now, what this corresponds to at, you know, the problem is that at finite lattice spacings, the determinant of the Dirac operator doesn't factorize. The fourth root, one way of saying, corresponds to taking putting a factor of a fourth in front of every quark loop, therefore averaging over the contributions to each loop from the different tastes. And in the simulations, and we use hybrid molecular dynamics as part of the algorithm, it corresponds when you calculate, the only place it enters is when you calculate the fermion force. You average over the fermion force of the four tastes rather than summing of it. And of course, in the continuum limit, if the four tastes become degenerate, then that would appear to be the right thing to do. However, questions have been raised. It's on a finite lattice, this doesn't correspond to a field theory, and therefore, is it possible that non-localities enter, which persist in the continuum limit? Okay, so that is a major question for people who use staggered quarks. There's no evidence for non-localities to date, but that's not a satisfactory answer to that question. Right? So people have been working on this. I certainly don't want to spend all of this talking about fourth roots, but I want to point out a couple of things. This set of authors has looked at free Dirac operators, and they have indeed found Dirac operators which are local, which describe a single quark, and whose determinant is the fourth root of the staggered fermion determinant. That's nice, but the problems you would expect come in the interacting case. There's no such nice construction, but the people listed down below have looked at the eigenvalues of the Kogut-Susskind Dirac operator on smooth fields and increasingly small lattice spacings, although these are quenched studies. And what they find is that the eigenvalues tend to become fourfold degenerate. you can separate out the near zero and the non-zero modes. You don't expect exact zero modes except in the continuum limit with staggered course. The multiplicity of the near zero modes seems to be consistent with the index theorem, and the density of the low-lying non-zero modes seems to be consistent with the expected universal behavior. And let me just show you one figure from Durr and Heubling, where you both see the fourfold degeneracy, and on the left they've put up the eigenvalues of the overlap operator on the same set of configurations, and with one rescaling they can make it all match up. Okay, now, okay, so that's, again, it's not a proof, but it's encouraging. You know, I don't know that they haven't, Yeah, it's very hard to compare, right? Because you're talking about a different dimension, they have different dimensions even. Okay. So I'm not quite sure how to answer the question, but I have not seen anyone try to answer that question. It's very hard to compare. Remember that as far as doing simulations is concerned, is all you need is the determinant. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that there are a very large number of eigenvalues, and you can be just a little bit off in each eigenvalue, but then when you take the product to form the determinant, is not you aren't guaranteed here that those small differences don't add up to something that's unphysical. Right? So I'm not claiming that. Yeah, I mean, they smear these, right? And indeed, if you don't smear it out, they're certainly not going to be the same, because the short distance behavior of these Dirac operators is different. So if you believe that the large distance behavior of the theory is controlled by the small eigenvalues, then this is encouraging. But it's not, it's not a proof of anything. Yeah?
Obviously, the overlap ones have to be smeared. So
yes.
Staggered ones smeared as well?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody is smeared. They smear the gauge configurations, and then they apply the operators. Okay. So it's doing everything the same to the extent you can do everything the same. Okay. Okay. Here's some a different thing you can do, which I think is interesting. This is a calculation from Milk, in which we look at the topological susceptibility. There's raw data from the course and the fine lattices, and then using, again, staggered chiral perturbation theory to extrapolate to the continuum limit, you get these points. This is just leading order continuum staggered chiral perturbation theory in this line, and in this line it's the same thing except made to fit onto the quenched result. So that looks pretty reasonable. I think the best thing that we can say is first of all, I think that advocates like me of staggered quarks need to do a lot more thinking to see if we can give a really better justification than this naive one for the use of staggered quarks. There's no question that we need to do that. And however, what we have, having not succeeded in doing that up to this point, we have done is go on to try to calculate some things whose results are known experimentally, and see how that's going. Now, you have to fix some parameters. Give yourself a set of bare parameters in the Lagrangian. You need to know what lattice spacing that corresponds to, what the quark masses correspond to, how you fix them. So for the lattice spacing, We look at the splitting either 2s, 1s level in the upsilon spectrum, or the 1p, 1s, and its equivalent. The light quark mass and the strange quark mass are fixed from the pion and kaon masses, the charm quark from M sub B sub S, and the B quark mass from the 1s state in the upsilon spectrum. Here's one of the places where we won by giving away our lattices. We started out fixing the lattice spacing using that parameter R1 that you've seen in some earlier things from the heavy quark potential. That's very good for keeping the lattice spacing fixed as you say vary the light quark mass because it's something you can calculate accurately and very cheaply. But it's not really a physical quantity, so then you need to know what is R1. And the HPQCD collaboration was very anxious to calculate the upsilon spectrum, and they did these accurate calculations which set the lattice spacing. So we won by getting a much better evaluation of an absolute evaluation of the lattice spacing. The important thing is that once, with this small set of physical quantities, you fixed all the parameters, there's no remaining freedom. Okay, so you're stuck. If you calculate something and get the wrong answer, you know you're really doing something wrong. Okay, and the best way to test that, I think, is to calculate things which you can calculate accurately and which are quite straightforward, so there's no getting out of it if you get the wrong answer.
Yeah.
They're very close. They're very close. In fact, I should have mentioned that M sub S one was done by the Fermi Lab group. Okay, and so they calculated both charmonium and the heavy light mesons with charm quark. So there's very little difference. So the things which are easiest to calculate are those with stable hadrons or very narrow ones, so that things aren't oscillating back and forth, say between a rho and 2 pi or something. Although it's very important to learn how to deal with unstable particles. And earlier, Chris Michael was here and telling us about some nice work that UKQCD had done on that. Still, it's much easier if things are narrow. If there's only one hadron at most in the initial or final state, then you don't have to worry about initial or final state effects. The most important thing, I think, is to have the chiral extrapolation under control. And you can do that either by choosing to look at quantities which do not vary rapidly as a function of the light quark mass, because in leading order chiral perturbation theory, it doesn't depend on the light quark mass. Or quantities you can calculate very, very accurately and really do a good job of fitting to chiral perturbation theory. Okay. And if you have such quantities and they're well known experimentally, you can test what you're doing. And the interesting part is there are lots of quantities like that which are important phenomenologically. So there's a lot that could be done that's very interesting in this way. So, okay, here's from a couple of years ago now, our first attempt to do that. What we did was calculate a number of quantities on the lattice, divide by their experimental value. So everything should be 1. Okay. And some of these quantities, like f pi and fk, the leptonic decay constants of the pi and k, involve only light valence quarks. The 3 m cascade minus mn is again to cancel out at leading order the light quarks. There's some things with charmonium splitting, upsilon splittings. In the quenched approximation, you can't get them all. And here this looks very good. And this is joint work, people calculating different ones of these quantities by Fermilab group, HPQCD, our group, UKQCD. Okay, so this made us. Absolutely, absolutely. F pi and F k, and I'll show you this in a little bit, are fairly sensitive. The rest of them are purposely chosen not to be sensitive. Okay, if you have things that aren't sensitive, and you don't get the right answer, then you're really in trouble. Okay. That was chosen in order to cancel out the leading ordering chiral perturbation theory dependence on M light, right? So it was making a quantity that was not so dependent on the light quark masses. Yes, but that one is not so easy as far as the chiral extrapolation is concerned, because you're going from a regime in which the delta is stable, where you do the simulations, to one where it isn't stable. And so you have to be fairly careful about the chiral extrapolation of the nucleon. I'll show you how that looks now later. Excuse me? Yeah? Here. You mean this one?
No, the Fermilab.
Oh, the Fermilab. Oh, I'm sorry.
That was about 50% off. The experimental value is about 119, and the result one is below.
Yeah.
That is still.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it could be just a Fermilab one.
Yeah, I said. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Oh, yeah, this is a new calculation by HPQCD and their UKQCD. But, excuse me? I am, yes. I will for F pi. I'll show you. I will not do the, I'm not going to do the baryon except to show you where the nucleon is, okay? Okay. Here, these two groups are trying to calculate alpha strong. They look, this is a real tour de force, in my opinion. They look at 28 different Wilson loops. Of course, they're related, but they work to third order in perturbation theory in calculating these loops. And let's see, D is just a constant, which they have at their disposal. A is the lattice spacing. You can see these two dashed curves. That's just the continuum two-loop, the result from the continuum two-loop beta function, and the distance between the two dashed curves is the uncertainty that they're measuring the uncertainty in, or estimate of the uncertainty in setting the overall scale. So that looks very good. They convert that into alpha ms bar at the mass of the z, and then compare it with the results in the particle data book, and you see that there. This is a, yeah. Yeah. A closed loop, right, and with a gluon going, that still gets, if it's one closed loop, it still gets a 1/4. I mean, that's, yeah, yeah. Okay, so, good. Now, okay, the light pseudoscalars is something that, meaning the pi's and the k's, is something that Milk has put a fair amount of effort into. And here, the advantage is that for any given gauge coupling and set of quark masses, you can calculate the very high accuracy, the masses and the leptonic decay constants on the lattice. These are just very easy things to calculate. The difference in accuracy has to do with the mass of the light quarks. Aubin and Bernard have worked out staggered chiral perturbation theory for these quantities. And of course, MPI and MK, that part of it is used to set the light and strange quark masses. But it's possible both to, again, check what we're doing and obtain some, I think, interesting new results. So here's what the chiral perturbation theory looks like. This is, by the way, it's this is partially quenched in the sense that we take the freedom of having the valence mass quarks be different from the C quarks and also equal to their masses. And that gives us more data, and in doing the staggered chiral perturbation theory, one can separate out the C and the and the valence quarks. So I've only shown you a very small amount of the data here. The triangles are from these coarse or 0.125 Fermi lattices, different colors, different light quark masses, and then the the squares are from the 0.09 Fermi lattices. And you do an overall global fit to F pi and FK and M pi and MK. So you know where that gives you the pi and K masses, as I've said. These smooth curves are then from the are then from the fit at fixed lattice spacing. You can then turn off the terms that are order a squared or a squared alpha s and get the cyan curve. There's a small correction because we didn't at the very beginning get the strange quark mass exactly right, and that's the red dotted curve, which you can hardly distinguish from the cyan one, and then perform the extrapolation. Having set the C and the valence quark masses equal down to the physical point and get F pi. Okay. These cyan points are extrapolations at fixed quark mass to zero lattice spacing, and so it's a check on what we're doing. It's a different way of going to the continuum. Okay. Yeah? The Goldstone, I mean, we have looked at the Goldstone mass here, although, right, and that's what we've studied in particular detail. However, the quark, right, the, say it again, the quark masses, of course, are determined by, for example, the light quark mass is determined by having the Goldstone pion be the take on its physical value. Okay, that sets the quark mass. Okay, both, and if we want to set the valence quark mass, that's a parameter in the Lagrangian. Okay, and then we want to set the valence quark mass equal to the C quark mass. It just says when we calculate propagators on these lattices, the ML that's in those propagators is the same as was in the simulation. And the quark mass we used for that is the Gold. Well, in the staggered chiral perturbation theory, in the loops of that are all of the different tastes. Okay, so I think we're doing the average right, and then when we go to the continuum limit to a goes to zero, of course they all become degenerate. Yes, it's all in there. Yeah. We I guess I don't see what you're saying, but I
think we have that.
Yeah. Well, actually, we have four inside and four outside because the valence quarts are staggered too. Yeah. I don't think that that would make any difference because of the because in the end we're taking a limit in which all of the tastes become degenerate. We can talk about that. Oops. Okay. 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 So here's some results of ours up there, and so the errors in the lattice results are statistical, and then our estimate of the systematic errors in our calculations. Oh, in the chiral expansion, we go up to next to leading order, but there we, yeah. And we also have divided our data, since there's an awful lot of data, into different sets. In other words, take only up to light masses, 4/10 of the strange quark mass, 6/10, and so on, to try to underestimate what errors we're making and what the the goodness of our fits, aside from just the statistical ones. This is a very long story, okay, and I can refer you to our paper on it, but this, I think, I mean, well, most the leadership of that was due to Claude Bernard, and I think he did an extremely careful job of looking, and I think we set out in this paper in really gory detail exactly what we did. Because we tried to fit the data in very many different ways, and I think central values did not change very much. And in fact, part of our systematic error was to say, if we do these fits differently, how do we, what happens? Okay. While we were doing this, Bill Marciano pointed out that, okay, excuse me. So there are results, and there are the, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah, the leading order volume dependence can also be estimated staggered chiral perturbation theory, and that was subtracted out. So I think that and that was an effect at 1% level. Excuse me? Oh, the range of M pi L we examined, let's see, the range of the light quark mass we examined, as I said, was between 1/10 the strange quark mass and a strange quark mass, and that's between 250 MeV for the pion. Oh, M pi L for the lighter mass. I said that that was, it's approximately 3.8 to 4. Well, I think we didn't find that. Oh, the first is statistical and the second is systematic, or our estimate is systematic. Okay. And again, I think it compares pretty favorably with the experimental results. While we were doing this, as I said, Marciano pointed out that if you really did a good job of fk over f pi, you had a different way of calculating VUS. Given the experimental results for the k of pi and k to mu nu and inclusive gamma. And so here's our result in the particle data book result and more recent result from KTEV. I think you want this to have moved higher than the particle data result because it was about two standard deviations below what was needed for the unitarity of the CKM matrix. So that's good. Now this is something where we expect the errors to really go down in the next year as we as these new lattices, which I told you about, are generated. You can also, wow, I'm going way slow. So let me hurry. You can also calculate light quark masses. Here you need to do matching for MS and ML individually. And actually the biggest errors in here are the fact that it's only been done to one loop perturbation theory. You can actually, by fussing around with pi plus pi zero and k plus k zero mass differences, estimate independently the up and down quark masses. And because the fact that you've not in the simulations had the up and down quark masses, because you in the simulation you have had the up and down quark masses to be equal, but that's a second order kind of perturbation theory effect. The biggest error here is in our rough estimation of the effects of electromagnetism, which are not included in the simulation. Yep. Excuse me? Yes. The renormalization, you need to calculate the renormalization constants to match the lattice results to the continuum results. So that's only been done in one loop perturbation theory. The two loop perturbation theory is in progress by our friends in HPQCD. Yes, although I think it's consistent with the latest results that are in the literature. They wander a little bit, but I think this is consistent with that. Okay. Well, again, I got to pick up the pace. You all know why you want to calculate the hadron spectrum. Here's sort of an overview where in blue are the things that are used to fix the quark masses and the lattice spacing, and in the other cases are the everything in red is then what we measured. Well, the nucleon is not too bad after doing some chiral perturbation fit, which I don't have time to talk about. I'd just like to, though, would like to call attention to the omega minus, because that is sensitive only to the strange quark mass, and it therefore, we think, serves as a real check on our determination of the strange quark mass from the kaon mass. So that was nice. Just to show you from HPQCD, their calculation of the splittings in the epsilon spectrum. Again, here they've taken the 2s, 1s to set the lattice spacing, and then the 1p, 1s is very flat and independent for light quark mass. That looks nice. The place where I think in the immediate future there's is the biggest payoff is in studying the weak interactions of hadrons. One example which we've been particularly interested in is in the study of the decays and mixing of B and D mesons. There's, as you know, a very large international effort from Bell in Japan to Babar at SLAC and D0 and CDF at Fermilab and the CLIO-C experiment at Cornell to study these quantities, both to determine elements of the CKM matrix and to make tests of the standard model by determining the same CKM matrix elements from different experiments, and thereby looking for possible breakdowns in the standard model. In many cases, you need a lattice calculation to go from experiment to the CKM matrix element. And in most cases, it's the uncertainty in the lattice calculations that limit the accuracy of the results. This is now a year and a half or so old, but it shows sort of what the situation is. Each of these colors represents a different experiment and lattice calculation, except the sine 2 beta, which doesn't depend on the lattice at all. They all have to agree, which means that those purple lines, which represent 65%, 95% confidence levels, are the regions where they overlap. But the idea is then to squeeze down these different colored bands enough to see if you really have consistency. And again, the lattice errors predominate. Here's something that we made up last year when we were trying to convince the DOE and HEPAP to fund lattice computing facilities. In the left column is what you measure. The second column is the affected CKM matrix element. The third column is what you need to calculate on the lattice. The non-lattice errors, which are predominantly experimental, the lattice errors as of last year, which you can see in every case where you have both, are significantly. The errors which we think we can beat things down to with the existing lattices, which in this thing were called nil zero, and then the errors which we think will result from the sets of lattices we're currently generating. So some we're doing this, HPQCD is doing this. We're starting with the D mesons because CLIO-C is going to measure the properties of D decays very accurately, and that will provide a very good test of what we're doing. Then we'll use the same methodology to discuss B mesons, where you're not going to have the experiments anytime soon, but where you need them to calculate the CKM matrix element. So here's some preliminary results from Fermilab and Milk on F sub D sub S. And let me just again show you the results and very preliminary CLIO-C results, only from a few decays in each case. But the CLIO-C results are going to improve very significantly over the next year. And we hope the lattice results will improve very significantly over the next year. Again, the errors are statistical and systematic, because these are only from the coarse lattices. We're in the middle of analyzing the small spacing, the 0.09 Fermi. And the biggest errors here are the uncertainties from the finite lattice spacing errors. Okay. Here's some calculations for D and K decay of the previous. This is the leptonic form factor of F sub D sub S. Here we're looking at the semi-leptonic decays, which are parameterized by two form factors, which depend on Q squared, the momentum transfer between the D and the pi or the K. And again, there are experimental results for Q squared equals zero, which look okay. This is a graph due to the FOCUS collaboration, which came out after we had done these calculations. So the purple are the experimental results, the greens are ours, and then there are these fits, the phenomenological models. Again, of course, the Q squared depends are very smooth here, so you can argue about how much about this, but we seem to have gotten that part right. And again, some comparisons with experimental results. And again, it looks reasonable. 2 minutes. I don't know, maybe I should skip the high temperature QCD because people are going to want to eat lunch. But I think we were trying to calculate the, to look at the phase diagram, and again, this is with 2+1, the strange quark at its physical value in MY varied, and these black points are linear extrapolations from the two lightest light quark masses down to zero quark mass. So I think you would say that the transition, if this is this down there, we said would estimate the temperature at about 170 MeV. And that's done from looking at susceptibilities. You see that the transition sharpens up as you go to lighter quark mass, but it doesn't, it really looks like a crossover rather than a phase transition. One of the things that's really interesting to look at is quark number susceptibilities, the derivative of the expectation value of the quark number with respect to the chemical potential coupled to the quark, because those are related to event-by-event fluctuations in heavy ion collisions. So these are interesting physical things. You don't measure little the quark number susceptibility, but instead you look at baryon number, hypercharge number, isospin number. And the point here is that of this graph is that one looks at different number of temporal time slices in the simulation, and as NT increases, the last spacing decreases, so it doubles from 4 to 8. Look at different aspect ratios for spatial to temporal volume. And because of this action is so nicely improved, you are already getting very good agreement at these three different lattice spacings. And you see this steep growth as you go through the transition temperature. And here's looking at the isospin baryon hypercharge. And the correlations between baryon number and hypercharge, which are significant only in the region of the crossover. And there are no correlations between the isospin fluctuations and the others for equal mass quarks. Okay, well, to summarize then, there's a lot of different topics being discussed with these zero temperature lattices, some of which I've covered and some of which I haven't. There are lots of people who are using them. There's some 40 people on this list who've written papers with these configurations. Here's again what we're gonna do in the next year and how much it's gonna cost. A teraflop year is the number of floating point operations a computer running at 1 teraflop will spit out in 1 year. So these are significant. If you look beyond that, I would say these are so significant that you probably do not want to do them. I think if you had computing power that would let you do these bottom ones, you would want to invest it in actions with exact or nearly exact chiral symmetry. So I think that this program, as far as the lattice generation part of it, is probably either going to come to an end or come to certainly a pause. But I think that these new and existing configurations are really going to improve our ability to calculate some of these quantities I've been talking about. UKQCD is going to do some very high statistic runs at one particular quark mass that we've already studied, and that ought to enable them to look at the masses of flavor singlet mesons and exotics and glue balls. I think that, you know, we're right now looking at the equation of state. The Bielefeld group is joining forces with the RBC collaboration, and I think that they have a very, very nice program with a different version of staggered courts, which they call P4, but also has everything through order A squared, all lattice artifacts through order A squared eliminated. So I think there's going to be a lot of progress in looking at high temperatures. Finite baryon density, that's a major challenge, but they're going to be, I think progress is being made, and we're going to hear a lot of talks about that later in this meeting. But as I just said, I think the focus of the large scale configuration generation is going to shift in the next year or two to actions with exact chiral symmetry. And my own opinion is what that's going to do is both test and I think confirm the calculations with staggered courts. At least I hope it will. And that would be very interesting to see. So I'm sorry I ran over time. Julius.
You obviously spoke a great deal more about the using this problem, but if I take the four things of the determinant and the growing evidence that it's kind of a local theory, what is the deep reason that it's so difficult to find the actual and effective local action which would be close to the multi-band? It's not too variable. A local FST is a measure of action which can be then taken to the actual and to the result.
Well, as I said, for free fermions, that's been done. There are different examples of it, in fact. But with arbitrary gauge fields, that's, well, it's not obvious to me. Let me put it that way. Now, that would be clearly the thing one would like to do. And of course, it doesn't need to be that it's exact. I mean, it would be nice just to be of order A squared approximate. If you could exhibit such an action with differences that were of order A squared, you would be just delighted. Okay. Or I would be just delighted anyway, provided it was local. But we have not succeeded in doing that yet. I mean, it's not, people have try, but it just doesn't mean.
There is an argument of
for 40 degrees. And that's for free quartz.
But I hope to make sure that would be an
approximate that's what he argues for free quartz. Okay. Then things start, right? I mean, my reading of this paper, at least, is that it's a very, very nice argument for the free quartz, and then he has such an action. But he says there is when you put in the gauge fields, then you cannot analytically do everything he has done and put bounds on everything the way he has, and he has some non-rigorous arguments and some tests. It could be done of his ideas in the interacting case, some numerical tests, okay? And we're thinking about how one might do that. But it is for, very nice. I mean, there's also this paper by Pierden and Maresca where they numerically, they do an expansion and numerically calculate the coefficients, again, for free quarks, which, by going further in their expansion, get arbitrarily close to a theory describing one quark whose determinant is 1/4 the Covey-Tuscan determinant. Okay, but again, it's not interacting. You could take that. You could take their action, engage it clearly, but you wouldn't. You would still. It would still remain to prove that the that that gives the same results as the Covey-Tuscan with the fourth derivative determinant. So it's just hard to do this analytically. Robert, you had a.
Okay. Let's wait for lunch and then come back at 2 o'clock.